Yesterday, we were asking the question, why Iraq? And Professor Noam Chomsky had joined us to answer that question. And today, we'd like to ask, why war? And particularly talk about the culture of violence that is created by military training and that comes home with soldiers. So I wonder, Heather, if you could give us an overview. You, not too long ago, published an article called Toxic Jihad, specifically addressing the kinds of impacts that not only military training, but military medicines have on soldiers. So maybe you can just introduce the topic for us.
Well, that particular piece actually dealt with depleted uranium. And since then, I've also written other articles that have to do with other stressors that that service members have gone through. What's interesting is that in the Fort Bragg case, which we will discuss later, in which four women were killed by their soldier husbands, there was a study done by the government into the causes, and they came up with issues such as combat and deployment experiences. They called it work-related stress, stigma against psychological counseling, inadequate family support services, and inconsistent soldier reacclimation programs. And so clearly these are some of the elements that are involved, but there are many others that the government doesn't talk about, but they are very, very important in this case.
Well, let's talk about this question of violence. The Army is faced with this sort of dilemma. It must train soldiers to be brutal and efficient killers overseas, but when they come home, how does the Army then take the responsibility for turning that training off? And we've seen in the last year a couple of incidences coming out of Fort Bragg, where soldiers have brutalized their wives. And in addition to the Edmonton Garrison here in Canada, there was an incident earlier last year where a soldier drove a car on a sort of rampage, and it caused quite a stir in the Canadian press, but the military attributing much of what had happened to this individual soldier to post-traumatic stress disorder. And just to read you a quote from an article that came from the Gazette concerning this incident, there was a military ombudsman who had produced a report looking at the impact of post-traumatic stress disorder. In his report, he said that half of the Canadian soldiers who come back from tough missions abroad may suffer from psychological problems, and perhaps one-fifth suffer from full-blown post-traumatic stress disorder. And Heather, you have your own sort of statistics looking at the impact of war on soldiers that just don't come only from post-traumatic stress disorder. I wonder if you can give us an overview of the kinds of statistics that you've found, and maybe even your comments on this notion that it's attributed to post-traumatic stress disorder by the military so often when soldiers bring violence home.
Well, you know, one interesting point of that is the Washington sniper, John Muhammad, is a case in point for what you're talking about right now. Apparently, he was violent before he served in the Persian Gulf, but when he came back, he was out of control violent, and he told his ex-wife, quote, "You have become the enemy, and as the enemy, I will kill you," kind of thing. So, I mean, clearly, this is a case of there is no reacclimation program that is available. Now, the kind of statistics that perhaps we could talk about, and again, the kind of statistics that you just said would be a very good reason not to get involved in any more wars, I mean, if this is the case. But there are other issues, for example, that our soldiers have been given horrible medications. For example, there is Larium, which is an anti-malarial medication that has been, it basically is a factor in Corporal Christian McEachern's, who is the gentleman who drove into the garrison in Edmonton. His lawyers are arguing that his post-traumatic stress syndrome is not necessarily due to the fighting as much as to this very destructive medication. We also have to keep in mind that many of the soldiers, I mean hundreds of thousands, have been exposed to depleted uranium, which has really horrifying physical effects. Also, the largest, if you could call it friendly fire disaster, occurred in the Gulf War when 100,000 soldiers were subjected to chemical warfare because they accidentally bombed this chemical plant and then were in the vicinity. The problem is that when these people come back, there is just zilch in support for them. In my country, the Secretary of Defense, Rumsfeld, a couple of weeks ago made this horrifying comment, essentially saying that the people who were drafted into the Army were of no real value, they were expendable. I think he was trying to say that he wasn't for the draft, but in essence, what he was saying is they were just kind of pawns in his little game or something. And so the issue that you are talking about right now is what kind of support do these people get at home? And clearly also a case is what kind of support do the families also get of these people when they come home? And at present, it really is quite weak.
Well, I'd like to talk a bit more about the impacts of war on families and societies, but let's first get into the details of this drug, Laramie, and something else you've mentioned, which is depleted uranium. Could you give us the details of what Laramie is? Because recently, Hoffman LaRoche, which is the company that produces this medication or this pharmaceutical drug, was required to print a label on its drug that reads, may cause psychiatric symptoms in numbers of patients ranging from anxiety, paranoia, and depression to hallucinations and psychotic behavior. And it was also reported in an investigative report published in Vanity Fair in December of 2002 that a number of soldiers refer to this drug, Laramie, as Psycho Tuesdays and Nightmare Wednesdays. Could you tell us a bit more about Laramie, what its impact is physically on the soldiers, and also much more about this thing that you're calling depleted uranium?
Yes, yes. Well, you know, the interesting thing about Laramie is actually the U.S. Army invented it, and then they licensed it to Hoffman LaRoche. And so, and basically another term that is used to describe this is mesloquine. It's an anti-malarial drug, but there are others that are far less toxic that are available. For example, doxycycline is one that is used instead of this. The problem is that if the Army, and if any Army acknowledges the incredible dangers of Larium, then they are going to be faced with a lot of lawsuits, because they have basically forced hundreds of thousands of people to take this drug. And so it's easier to pretend that it basically everything is okay. Now, since 1989, the package, as you said, warned of neuropsychiatric, they said, events such as psychosis, anxiety, and depression. But after the Fort Bragg incident, they amended the inside label to include that it could lead to, quote, rare cases of suicidal thoughts. And so clearly they understand that there's a problem with Larium, but UPI recently reported that the U.S. Army said while there was, quote, sufficient evidence to question the use of Larium, there was not sufficient evidence to stop using it, which would indicate that they're going to, you know, keep on using it in future conflicts. What's also interesting is that Christian McEachern, the gentleman who drove his SUV into the garrison headquarters in Edmonton, he had used it in 1997 in Rwanda. That's when he was given it. One thing about Larium is that the side effects can continue, Roche says, quote, long after people stop taking it. I mean, we're talking 5, 10 longer years. So this is something that is debilitating in a long term and so incredibly damaging. I mean, obviously.
Well, let's talk about, are you done with Laramie? I'm sorry.
Well, we could go on and on, but we can also hit depleted uranium.
That's what I want to move on to is this depleted uranium. Mm-hmm. One of the things that you published in your article, mm-hmm. Toxic Jihad, Our Hidden Bombs, which is available on your website at heathervokush.com. That's Heather, WOKUSCH.com. And in that article, you have some statistics from the Gulf War. You write, 147 U.S. troops were killed in action in the Gulf War. Almost 7,800 have died since. And close to 200,000, or a whopping 28%, have filed claims for medical and compensation benefits. The UK figures are proportionately similar, and shockingly, of the 537 UK vets that have died since the Gulf War ended, a full 70% killed themselves. And in this article, you ask the question, the suspected culprit, and one of the things that you talk about is depleted uranium. So I wonder if you can share with us, what is the relationship between this massive amount of death that has occurred among the veterans from the Gulf War and this thing called depleted uranium?
Well, you know, it would be logical that we should know what that relationship is now, but there has been, I would suggest basically a cover-up, because also depleted uranium has been used, for example, in the Balkans conflict. It will no doubt be used in this next Iraq conflict. And one of the problems is that there just have not been adequate studies done. For example, in the latest, many times the government waits for Gulf War veterans essentially to die, and so they have been dead too long for autopsies to be performed. It's very interesting that the United Nations Environment Program took a full 18 months after the Balkan conflict to even begin investigating post-war uranium contamination. And even as late as last year, the U.S. and U.K. governments vetoed a proposed World Health Organization study into the effects of DU on Iraqi civilians. And so, basically, we can't really tell 100% what the effects are. But basically, I mean, depleted uranium, 99% of the nuclear industry uranium waste is DU. And so, basically, we're shooting nuclear waste into other countries. And the dust that comes up when one of these bombs, you know, hits is quite lethal. Now, some of these horrible symptoms that the Gulf War vets have experienced could be due to depleted uranium. They could be due to things like larium or other unproved vaccines and drugs. It could be due to a number of different factors. There should have been proper studies done to find out exactly what was going on. But unfortunately, what happened is many times when the vets returned, they just got the runaround. And basically, not a lot of follow-up. And it's terrifying to think that we could be stepping into the same situation again.
Well, let's talk about the impact on our societies and our families. If these nuclear weapons, in fact, are being used, what kind of impact does it have when the soldiers return home? We know that the history of the military and the history of soldiers serving in that military has resulted in a high rate of violence and psychotic escapades, as we've seen, but also in the death that you have documented in your article, Toxic Jihad. In the United States, there has been a long string of deaths resulting from domestic violence, at least since the 1970s, where repeatedly soldiers, many of them located at Fort Bragg, have engaged in severe conjugal violence, not only resulting in the death of family members, but also ending for many of these soldiers in suicide. So when this culture of violence comes home, what is the impact at the family level?
Well, I mean, clearly it would be devastating at the family level. And the interesting thing also, or the horrific thing also, is the fact that these family members get basically zilch for support. After, in you know, this June and July spate of killings in which four women died, two men committed suicide, four men were killed by their military spouse husbands. What's interesting and relatively unreported is just last December, another guy named Sergeant Branch also tried to kill his wife and three small kids. Now, this guy had also been given larium, and many people were saying his behavior had changed very much. Now, the Army's reaction to supporting this woman after she essentially had almost died was they gave her only $476 so she could take a 20-hour bus ride with her three small kids, including a baby, to try to go someplace safe. You know, I mean, that's not exactly much support. And what this woman said was she could understand why these other women ended up dying, because essentially there's a complete denial of the crises that are facing these families and the violence. There's also a culture, not only a culture of violence, but, you know, also a culture of don't talk about it. If there's a stigma against psychological counseling. And this works together clearly with this culture of violence. And so now, for example, the military has said that it would screen returning soldiers for signs of mental health problems, but if they're not willing to talk about things like larium, and if there still is this culture of fear to actually talk about your feelings, well, I don't think they're going to get very far, and we could be experiencing even more domestic violence situations.
It seems like that culture of silence is also extended into the mass media, and thus also within the citizens of our society who are not being informed as to what DU or depleted uranium is, who are not being informed as to what the repercussions of the kinds of drugs that the military is giving its soldiers. What do you think can be done about this culture of silence that exists not only within the military but within the society when it comes to talking about soldiers coming back into our communities?
Well, I think that's a very interesting point and also a very frightening one. And when you consider that, for example, Colin Powell's son is now in charge of our, you know, media conglomerate, if you will, in the States. And his effective job now is making huge mergers of all of these big media corporations to further limit the amount of reporting that can actually be done. You've got to consider, for example, that General Electric owns NBC and on. So many weapons manufacturers have a direct line into the very few media corporations that are left. And so, of course, you're not going to see negative reporting on the military. Military's activities, and you're not going to see reporting talking about how unfairly the military members have been treated once they have returned home. Everything is going to be happy, happy, and we love war, basically. And so that is another, it's another very, very dangerous development that is happening right now.
Well, one of the things that we're trying to do, at least within our community media access abilities, is to talk about why war, why we have this choice of war before us, because it is clearly a choice. It's on the headlines every day. The Canadian government has been sort of going back and forth in terms of support, standing behind the United States nations, or and then changing the next day and standing behind the United States. But this question is never put to the public, should we engage in war in the first place? It's just whether we're going to engage in war with the UN support or whether we're going to engage in war with the United States support. And one of the questions that I wanted to ask you, Heather, because you've clearly considered the impacts of war on soldiers, could you also give us your assessment of the impact of war on society?
Well, on society, I mean, we also have to take into consideration on the society that is being bombed. You know, for example, I would like to hit 2 points, if I may. I wrote a different article called Material Breach, the U.S. Crimes in Iraq. And while we now are talking about the horrible Iraq breaches for UN 1441, what the media doesn't talk about is the fact that back in the first Gulf War, the U.S. and allies bombed their electricity plants, which served their nation's water treatment facilities, which in essence destroyed the drinking water for much of the population. And that water was not allowed to be, you know, uncontaminated because of the sanctions. And so not only have we left this horrible radioactive depleted uranium in the countries, which has led to, you know, extensive birth defects among Iraqi civilians, that also destroyed their water supply. I mean, can you imagine if somebody came and did this to Montreal or any city that people live in? This is a war crime, essentially, what happened to these people. And can you imagine what they are living with right now, thinking, great, you know, any second now, you know, we could be bombed and everything could die, you know. So that kind of stress is clearly awful. Now, to get back to your question, why war on this side as far as quote unquote the good guys, which I would tend to highly disagree with. I mean, I think to a large extent it comes down to money. It comes down to the oil issue that the government wants. And in my country, in the States right now, I mean, essentially the economy is not doing very well, and Bush has used a lot of money for very, you know, silly things. And so he needs to go and have some kind of victory, quote-unquote, that the media can talk about and say what a great leader he is. And he can't attack North Korea because they can actually fight back. And so what's left, great, you know, he'll just go and hit Iraq, basically, and it doesn't really matter the, quote, collateral damage that's left behind. So I don't know that the people on the ground actually believe in this. There is a lot of dissent against this whole idea of war, but this dissent, again, is not reported by the corporate media as much as it should be.
And neither are the dangers, which is the point that you clearly make in your article, Toxic Jihad. You conclude the piece with this quote, at issue are the toxic dangers at home and abroad. And I would add that also at issue is the violence linked by governmental and corporate denial regarding the deadly effects on the population. We must expose our hidden bombs, and I would add our hidden violence, for what they are, and then demand justice for those afflicted and to fight to prevent new casualties. I wonder if you could give us your thoughts on the abilities of people to counter this notion of the hidden violence and the hidden toxicity of war, and bring it up to the level to have a real meaningful social discussion. Is it possible to bring these things out for the public to assess?
Well, I think people like you are doing it, and I think that's very, very important and highly, highly admirable. I think that once you get onto, for example, the corporate-owned media, I don't see it happening nearly enough, and that is an issue. But the more that you talk about it on your radio station, and the more you get other people talking about it, then hopefully things could filter up and to get the corporate media talking about it. I mean, when you talk to just normal people on the street, I think they're just very, very confused right now, because on the one hand, they're being fed, oh, well, this person is evil and we have to stop. But on the other hand, it's normal people, and they have kids, and they're interested in the world surviving, and most people aren't highly, highly violent. And so there's a lot of confusion. You know, I should say, my articles tend to be really, really kind of liberal and a left wing. A lot of the people that read my articles and that respond, I probably get 100 emails a day. I would say at this point probably 20 are from veterans, or either veterans or sometimes even active soldiers. And many of them are saying, I don't understand what's going on here. I don't think this is right. And, you know, if you have a person who essentially doesn't even believe in the kind of violence that the person is being asked to do, wow, I mean, what kind of situation is that person in? And so this whole theme of violence extends not only to the country being attacked and the people back home, but also the people who currently are in the military serving or who have retired. And so it is pervasive. And one would hope that with decent leadership, this theme of violence would instead turn into something, for example, of, you know, nurturing or saving the environment, or how can we honor diversity or something of that nature. Can you imagine if all of the money that has been spent on weaponry instead had been spent on elements of peace? I mean, my goodness, it would be a very different world. And I don't know when we will get to that point.
Well, Heather, thank you very much for your contribution to this discussion. If people would like to check out Toxic Jihad or any other writings, Heather Vakush's website is online at heatherwokush.com. Do check it out. Thanks so much, Heather, for joining us today.
Okay, thank you very much, Gretchen.